From Virginia to Montana, Nebraska to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, government statistics do not paint an accurate picture of the nation's unemployment rate, but the comprehensive unemployment rate calculated by the Mercatus Center does. Michael Farron is here with details. The nation's capital was rocked this past week when House Speaker Paul Ryan announced his retirement. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with the real story on the impact. Republicans have passed a balanced budget amendment through the U.S. House of Representatives, but Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why it was an empty gesture. And President Trump's ratcheting up of trade tariffs finally reflect the reality of post-World War II international competition. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Critics have maintained that the official unemployment rate calculated by the U.S. government fails to include those Americans who have simply given up seeking a job. Michael Farron is a research fellow at the Project for the Study of American Capitalism at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. They produce a comprehensive jobless rate, which more accurately calculates unemployment in the nation's economy. Michael joins us to discuss the project. Michael, welcome to American Radio Journal. Michael, when we look at unemployment, there was a lot made through the course of the Great Recession and the Obama administration about what the real rate was, since so many Americans had really given up on trying to find a job. So tell us a little bit about how the government comes to arrive at its unemployment numbers, and then we'll talk a bit about what you do at Mercatus that actually gives us a more clear picture.
There is a survey that the government does every month called the Current Population Survey, and they ask people as part of this very long-running, one of the largest surveys in the world, that asks about 60,000 households a bunch of different things about their employment in the labor force, essentially whether or not someone is employed or not, whether they have looked for work within the last 4 weeks if they're not working, and if they're currently available for work. And if you meet all three of those criteria, then you are counted as officially unemployed. That's the headline unemployment rate that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out, and they also refer to that as the U3 rate.
Now, you at the Mercatus Center have developed your own way of calculating the unemployment rate, and it's called the comprehensive jobless rate because it is, as the title would indicate, more comprehensive. Can you walk us through your project, your calculations?
The comprehensive jobless rate gets around the problem that people have said in the past, that President Trump said this on the campaign trail as well as many different pundits, that the unemployment rate is much higher than what the BLS actually reports. And so what the comprehensive jobless rate does, it is the largest, most inclusive measure of joblessness that can be imagined. And so what it does is it counts everyone who says they want a job in that survey that I previously mentioned, everyone who wants a job, regardless of whether or not they have looked within the last 4 weeks or even within the last year, and regardless of whether they are actually currently available to take a job or not. So what this does is it picks up the people that fall through the cracks in the other measures of unemployment that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out, people like those miners or factory workers who may have lost their jobs over a year ago and haven't looked for work really since because they don't believe that there's any jobs available for them. But it also counts people like high school and college students who may be nearing graduation right now and are actively looking for a job but are not currently available to take one right at this moment.
As we look at the statistics that your more comprehensive study has produced, Michael, tell us where we stand. What is the actual jobless rate? And maybe give us a brief history going back for the last, say, 8 or 10 years, where we stand relative to where we were.
The current comprehensive jobless rate is 7.0%, and it reached a peak at 13.4% in late 2009. It's generally around 3.3% higher than the typical unemployment rate that you hear about. And this is important because while these numbers aren't small, they represent millions of people who want work, they're not nearly as large as what some pundits and politicians have said that the real unemployment rate is, that it could be anywhere from 20 or 30 or 40%. The situation is not nearly that dire, and the sky isn't falling, and the comprehensive jobless rate kind of gives us a metric to compare the other unemployment rates against. So it's a new measure that is more inclusive, but that doesn't mean that it's the be-all, end-all of unemployment rates. It's useful for comparing against the other unemployment rates, like U1, that measures long-term unemployment.
So it's not as bad as the doomsayers would say, maybe not as good as some politicians would have us believe. What is the long-term trend? Are we now rebounding significantly from the Great Recession?
Very much so, yes. We are actually at the best comprehensive jobless rate that we've been at in 17 years. The last time it was 7% was 2001, and the lowest that the comprehensive jobless rate has ever dropped was around 6.7% in the year 2000. So we are truly getting back to the best outcomes that we've ever seen in the U.S. economy since 2000 was the very end of the longest economic expansion in U.S. history.
Why then is it important that we have this more comprehensive study? Is it something that is used in terms of economic policy, economic planning by the private sector? Why do we need to know this?
It's interesting because it gives us another lens to analyze the economy through, and it gives that little bit of information helps give us a little bit more nuance about what's going on in the labor market. So, for example, this past month, the most recent jobs report has the unemployment rate at the official unemployment rate at 4.1%, and it stayed at that level since last October. However, the comprehensive jobless rate has gradually dipped a little bit over that time from about 7.3% to 7%. And at the same time, the new unemployment benefits claims for people who are newly out of work is at a 40-year low. So what all of this tells us is that new jobs are being created. Over the last 3 months, an average of 200,000 new jobs a month have been created. And the unemployment rate isn't going down, which is odd. And we don't see a lot of new people out of work either. So what this is suggesting is that people who have been on the sidelines of the labor force are now re-entering the labor force and essentially replacing the people who were actively looking for employment, the unemployed, while the people who were long-term unemployed are getting jobs. And the long-term unemployment rate is about 1.4%. The lowest it's ever been was about 1% or 0.9% in the year 2000. So we really are getting back to essentially the best outcomes that we've seen in a generation in the labor market. And that's what the comprehensive jobless rate is good for, giving us that little bit of extra information to help understand what's really going on.
We have been talking with Michael Farron, who is a research fellow at the Project for the Study of American Capitalism, that at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Michael, can you give us a little bit of information as to where folks can go if they would like to learn more about this, perhaps read your study?
You can go to mercatus.org and search for my name, Michael, F-A-R-R-E-N, Farron. And there's a very easy-to-read policy brief there and also blog posts that I do regularly on the state of the labor market.
Michael Farron of the Mercatus Center. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thank you, sir.
Our friend Andy Roth is, as usual, at the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., a capital city where there's been a lot of things happening this week. We're going to talk about them. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The sitting Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives has announced he isn't going to run for re-election. As we look at Paul Ryan's departure, does this retirement, Andy, have any impact on the ability of Republicans to retain control of the House of Representatives?
Well, the Democrats are certainly energized by it. So in one sense, it will make it harder. Ryan's district itself is not exactly a rock-ribbed conservative district. The Democrat challenger to Paul Ryan, I think, has over $1 or $2 million cash on hand, which is a remarkable sum of money to have as a Democrat against a sitting speaker. Now that the speaker has announced his retirement, that Democrat is going to have the leg up on any Republican who will emerge after Ryan leaves. That Republican will have less name ID, less popularity, probably a lot less money. So I think that seat itself will go to the Democrats, or could go. And then just the overall sentiment among Democrats is that it's opening up donors' pockets, and that's going to help the Democrats. But that's, I think, the extent of it.
To refresh our listeners' memory, what is the size of the current Republican majority? How many seats do Democrats have to flip in order to gain the majority?
They don't have to pick up that many. I think it's roughly in the lower 20s. And just so you can understand the scope of the problem, there are like over 90 seats that are viewed as competitive. Now, the Democrats aren't going to win all 90, and they may not even win half. But they have a very low bar with which to gain the majority. And when you look at the generic ballot, which is just, would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat? The Democrats have a high single-digit or low double-digit lead. And those are the kinds of numbers that you see in wave elections, like the one that favored Democrats in 2006 and the one that favored Republicans in 2010. So things need to change if Republicans want to stay in the majority.
With Paul Ryan's departure, then, Republicans are going to have to select either someone who will be the new Speaker of the House if Republicans retain the majority, or the Republican minority leader if they do not. I would imagine, Andy, that Paul Ryan's retirement has set off a scramble.
Yeah, it has. And this is going to be an interesting race. There's an interesting dynamic here. Remember that the speaker is picked by the entire House. So it is a floor vote. Democrats and Republicans vote on the speaker. And obviously, the party that's in the majority usually gets to pick who the speaker is. But for minority leader, if the Republicans lose the majority and they become the minority, that is just a conference vote among Republicans. So they go behind closed doors, they have a secret ballot, and the majority wins. So let's just say that after the November elections, the Republicans lose the majority, and they have 200 members in the U.S. House. Those 200 members go behind closed doors, and whoever gets 101 votes is the new minority leader. That changes things dramatically. Now, our argument about whether it's speaker or minority leader or majority leader or whatever, our argument is that if you want things to stay the same, if you want the Republican House Republicans to remain paralyzed and to constantly cave to Democrats, then picking the next successor is Kevin McCarthy or Steve Scalise. Because the way these races work is they all look around and see who's next in line. When Denny Hastert was Speaker, John Boehner was next in line. When John Boehner retired, everybody thought Kevin McCarthy was next in line. Now, he found out he didn't have the votes, so he backed out, and the conference picked Paul Ryan. But now that Paul Ryan is leaving, people are going to look at Kevin McCarthy again, or Steve Scalise, because they're next in line. I think if conservatives are serious, they need a change agent or somebody who's going to shake things up. And it's not going to be those two guys. If you support paralysis and apathy, McCarthy and Scalise are your candidates. But if you want the House Republicans to do something, you're going to have to find somebody else.
The fact that there is such advance notice that this is going to occur, we won't have this selection of a speaker or a Republican leader until mid-November. Does this give conservatives a rare opportunity to organize and compete for these leadership positions?
Yes, and that scares the dickens out of the establishment. In fact, if you see some machinations where they bring the speaker's vote forward, either, you know, like in a couple weeks from now or sometime in the summer, then you know something's afoot, and it's only going to benefit McCarthy and Scalise. If you give House Republicans 7 months, then I think that very much plays to conservatives.
We have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, we'd like to know a little bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll talk with you next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
A constitutional amendment requiring the federal government balance its budget sounds like a good idea. But although Republicans voted for it, their actions don't match their words. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why.
The House of Representatives voted Thursday on a balanced budget amendment. That is something that fiscal conservatives and Tea Party activists have long sought after. But unfortunately, this vote comes a month late and about $1 trillion short. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking just one more look back at exactly what the final few months of Speaker Paul Ryan's tenure as Speaker of the House and as leader of a House Republican caucus that was poised to implement some fiscally conservative policies, what that's actually resulted in. And I think all of it culminates in Thursday's vote for that balanced budget amendment, because I think you could argue that there's really nothing that better exemplifies or better sums up the current era of Congress under Republican control than this vote. And coming as it does the day after that Ryan announced his decision to retire from the House and retire from the speakership at the end of this session, well, that just makes the metaphor all the more apt. Look, Republicans reclaimed the House in 2010 with promises to oppose the runaway spending of the Obama and Bush eras with their stimulus and their bailouts and their expansion of government control over health care and everything else. Conservatives elected by the newly founded Tea Party movement railed against trillion-dollar deficits that threatened to bankrupt the country or push those debts off to their grandchildren. And the rest of the GOP got in line, at least rhetorically. Remember that in 2012, the Republican presidential platform promised an immediate reduction in federal spending and long-range fiscal controls. Ryan became the dashing, darling young leader of the fiscal hawks in the House Republicans, with all of his charts and his graphs and his floor speeches predicting economic catastrophe unless drastic action was taken to bring the budget, to bring the deficit under control. He had a plan to balance the budget, and he parlayed that commitment to number crunching and fiscal austerity into being first the chairman of the powerful House Budget Committee, and then eventually worked his way up to become Speaker of the House after John Boehner was ousted. And if you knew nothing, if you knew absolutely nothing about what Republicans in Congress have done for the last 15 months while they've controlled not just the House and Senate, but also the White House, then Thursday's vote on a balanced budget amendment would make perfect sense. It would be the crowning achievement of a conservative government that, having finally rid itself of Democratic leaders and a Democratic president and their spendthrift ways, would have been able to follow through on their pledges to set the country on a course towards fiscal sanity. And the final step in that course could have been a constitutional amendment to spare future lawmakers the temptation of straying from Ryan's carefully calculated balanced budget path. Instead, Thursday's vote was an empty gesture. Worse, it was a hypocritical one. Ryan's final term in Congress will be remembered for the passage of a major tax cut, yes, but it will also be remembered for the passage of a $1.3 trillion spending binge that cements trillion-dollar deficits for at least the next 10 years and probably much longer. And passing a balanced budget amendment won't change that. That's exactly what Representative Mark Meadows meant when he told Politico this week that there's no one on Capitol Hill and certainly no one on Main Street who's taking this vote seriously. Without a plan to achieve a balanced budget and efforts to implement one, the amendment is just not a serious proposal, says Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. She says that we need a budget with a long-term fiscal plan that can be implemented and addresses our unsustainable debt head-on, not more meaningless messaging, delay, and denial. And that's unfortunately what we got. The time to pass that budget, the time to actually take a stand on being fiscally responsible, was about a month ago or 2 months ago when Congress was debating a two-year budget deal and then working on crafting a specific spending plan within that budget deal. Instead, Congress voted to hike spending by $400 billion over the next 2 years. It shattered the very spending caps that Ryan had once campaigned to impose. Republicans agreed to just keep on funding many of the domestic spending priorities of the Obama administration that they had literally spent years railing against, and they threw billions to the Pentagon without even waiting for the conclusion of an ongoing audit of the federal government's most unauditable department. Trump signed the spending bill, but only after he complained about it, threatening to veto it, and then saying that he would never sign a bill like it ever again. So in other words, more empty gestures that mean nothing. Combined with last year's tax reform, the spending bill will produce annual deficits of at least $1 trillion for the rest of the Trump presidency, the Congressional Budget Office reported this week. That means the tax bill that Ryan sold as the first step towards reducing the overall cost of government will only have put our fiscal situation further out of whack and only have mandated future tax increases to pay for all of it. If Congress doesn't allow individual tax rate reductions to expire as planned in the middle of the next decade, then the deficit will jump by another $722 billion, according to the CBO. By 2028, the CBO says that the national debt will be equal to our entire economic output, with our debt-to-GDP ratio reaching levels far greater than in any year since the end of World War II. Knowing all that, Republicans are still trying to pass this week's balanced budget amendment vote as if it was some sort of exercise in fiscal responsibility. Representative Mark Walker told Politico that he doesn't see this as a show vote. He said, "We need this. It's something that we've been talking about for years." And yes, he's right about that. The GOP has been doing a lot of talking. And look, in theory, a balanced budget amendment is actually a pretty good idea. It's one worth talking about. But after what Republicans have done to the federal budget over the past 4 months, pushing this amendment is nothing more than duplicitous pandering and vacuous virtue signaling, as Barbara Boland, a notable conservative commentator, put it this week. And then, of course, there's questions of whether this amendment would ever actually do anything. Even if it does get through Congress and it would need a supermajority in both chambers to do that, then it would also need to be approved by 3/4 of the states. That's 38 out of 50 that are necessary to ratify an amendment to the Constitution. There are also very real questions about what the amendment would actually do if it did pass. Are entitlement programs included in the balanced budget, even though they run on autopilot? Are there exceptions for deficit spending during a recession or in the event of a war? And it's not at all clear to me what the enforcement mechanism would be here, because the Constitution assumes that Congress is capable of enforcing its own fiscal priorities. In this case, though, worrying about those particulars is pretty unnecessary. The goal here was not to actually pass an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but for lawmakers to be able to say that they voted to pass this amendment, to be able to run campaign ads in places like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania that talk about how Republicans are standing up for a balanced federal budget, even though the facts of the last few months say the exact opposite. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here on another edition of American Radio Journal next week.
The nation has taken a World War II era approach to international trade, and recent tariffs announced by the Trump administration are simply updating U.S. policy to reflect reality. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The decline in manufacturing jobs in the United States has been rapid. Contrary to popular belief, manufacturing employment was relatively stable in the 1960s and 70s. However, the rate of decline has been extraordinarily swift since 1979, when overall manufacturing jobs in the United States declined from 19.6 million jobs then to 13.7 million jobs in 2007. Manufacturing's decline has been exceptionally rapid due predominantly to trade imbalances, such as measured by our balance of trade and trade as well as trade barriers enacted by our partners. There are significant national security implications of a weakened manufacturing sector, to include the ability to defend oneself, as well as strategically weaken our ability to withstand an armed conflict or economic trade war. For instance, the ability of the United States to withstand World War II, despite the relative isolation of the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the United States, was due to America's manufacturing prowess. The United States was the world's arsenal. After World War II, the United States embarked on the Marshall Plan to rebuild a devastated Europe. Similar but less structured efforts existed in Japan when General MacArthur and his reconstruction efforts began there. Due to substantial destruction of worldwide manufacturing capability, the United States was well positioned in steel, rail, shipbuilding, aircraft manufacturing, mining, and our own financial strength to maintain a position of world power post-World War II. As our trade partners rebuilt and adopted modern manufacturing techniques, such as Dr. Deming and the Toyota system, many previously destroyed nations were able to rebuild and become effective trading partners with the United States. The United States adopted an almost patriarchal type attitude towards those devastated by World War II, and candidly, as someone who's worked in the steel industries in the 1970s, the industry and industries in general adopted a rather cavalier approach in many cases to the competition. This lackadaisical approach at senior leadership level hurt our nation and began a 20-year decline in our industry. In the 1970s and 1980s, rail, steel, automobile, and tool and die making began a death spiral, while at the same time our trading partners were growing rapidly. Many in industry felt the international trading partners were offered unfair competitive advantages through tariffs and trade barriers, putting U.S. manufacturing in jeopardy. Those of us in industry in the 1970s and 1980s became increasingly alarmed when tool and die making capability in the United States became outsourced internationally. From a military perspective, losing a nation's tool and die making capability puts a nation great strategic vulnerability, since we become dependent upon international sources for those materials necessary to survive in an armed conflict. The Defense Logistics Agency and the Joint Material Priority Allocations Board, JMPAB, as well as other Department of Defense and CIA agencies, would be concerned about strategic vulnerabilities in the nation's ability to defend itself in the time of war. During the Vietnam War, the nation fought a war of containment with an almost deliberate intent of constricting our military capabilities in a naive attempt at fighting fair. In this way, our nation did not commit its full capabilities to winning the war, with a devastating impact on those who fought and died there. The strategy scarred a nation to this day. In much the same way, our nation since 1960 has been trading internationally with a policy of appeasement and containment. It seems as if our nation has been embarrassed by its wealth since early 2000. This apparent embarrassment has left us unprepared for a competitive environment in which the world was not concurrently embarrassed and willingly applied tariffs against our products and services. The danger of the United States waging international trade with one hand tied behind its back or on an unlevel playing field is that we hurt the very citizens who are relying on mortgage-paying jobs that manufacturing provides. I've often suggested that tariffs hold little value in international trade, but that any tariffs employed should reflect that tariffs that your trading partners enact against U.S. products and services. The tariffs on steel and aluminum that President Trump has proposed can be a dangerous precedent and should not be taken lightly. By the same token, from a negotiating perspective, such a tariff may be indicating to the world that we intend to level the playing field in international trade and let the most efficient producer win. Interfering with markets is seldom a good idea, but perhaps the president is signaling a major shift in U.S. policy relative to trade, whereby we will no longer believe that our trading partners are the economically devastated, war-ravaged trading partners of World War II, but that we are all equal partners on the world stage. Perhaps apologetics has died. Perhaps competition and free enterprise will win. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, KJAAAM and KQSS-FM in Miami, Arizona. Welcome to our new listeners in the Grand Canyon State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.